taping today is February 2nd, and what I want to do is to show that some of the things we did last class ought to be considered to be done with the full approbation, full acquiescence of Chazal. No, I have a diverse group here. We have been trying to prove that ancient languages can shed light on Hebrew, the language of the Torah. Once a word appears in the Torah and it's not, it's Hebrew, even if its source is Akkadian or Ugaritic. Right? I may be preaching to the choir already on this, but I just want to show, I want to be sure that if anyone has any doubts of some of the things that are being done here, that if I can show that it's done in the Gemara, it shouldn't be. It should be okay that we're doing it here, right? Okay, so there are some words that you can you don't have to be a Hebrew linguist to know that a word like this, very common word, you're saying it every day, right? All right, that's not a Hebrew word. All right, what's it saying? You can ask for Akkadian to help you understand some nuances of that word. That's obviously a Hebrew word, and roots in Hebrew have they do a lot of work. Some roots have go many different directions. So a word like in last week's parsha, michuspas. All right. And again, you have to just feel it. If there's an Israeli in the room, you know this is not a Hebrew word, right? Okay, the chiddush of last class was that even a word like this is not a Hebrew word. Or a word like this, malach, socher, these are not Hebrew words. They originate in other languages. If anyone of you wants to go into linguistics, you know, we can show you the rules of how we know some of these things. But well, they tried to group you, especially with this word, last class. It's not a linguistic issue, it's a cultural issue. The Bible does not put out a good word for sailor because there were no sailors in Israel. So why do I have to have a word for something we don't see? Right? The Bible doesn't have too many words for snow because we don't see snow. There's an awful lot of words for rain. Okay, that's the point I made last class. Okay, so let's analyze this word right here. Totafos, according to the Gemara, is made up of two Chomite words. When I say Chomite, you know, there's Noah had three sons, Shem, Chom, and Yafet. They inhabited very different areas of the world. Yafet mostly went north. Right? Look at you just see their names and their descendants, they're all in the north. Greece, Rodanim, Yavan, they went north. The Chum nations, Kush, Fut, Mitzrayim, went south. And Shem, the Semites, took the Middle East. And parenthetically, this works well with Rashi, who says that Canaan took our land from us. And now when we want to come back after stay in Egypt, then they say, listen to them. Rashi apparently was very sensitive to this accusation, which continues to bog us to this day in the Middle East, that we took someone else's land. He said, wait a second, you took it from us first. Now that we want to take it back, now the UN forces come in with the cameras and everything and to say that someone else's. So Canaan was settled in the south. So if you're in a different geographical area, you're going to come up with different words. You're going to come up with different languages. It's not just a Migdal Bavel thing. The culture will produce different words, different languages, different alphabets. Fine. So the fact that the Gemara Maseches Menachos is willing to use Chomite, two different Chomite languages, they were aware of them. They said they called Afriki, African languages, to explain this difficult Hebrew word. Not only does it in a linguistic sense, it does it in a halachic sense. The Gemara darshens this word in terms of Chomite language. So it's obvious that we should be able to use Semitic languages to help us understand Hebrew. I, I'm probably preaching to the whole choir here. I mean, Rashi regularly uses Arabic to explain difficult words. Or I should say difficult concepts. I'll give an example here. The Pasuk in Mishlei says that find someone you are in love with, and be'ahavoso tishge tamid. In her love, you shall always be what? What is that?
Isn't that
today?
That usually creeps you down. Tishka.
No. Think of Pasuk in Dvarim. Tishke, not Tishkav. Yishkolene, Yishkolene. Yes, but it's in the Torah first. It's in Mishlei. The Ahavasa, in her love, Tishke Tamid. Now, the Rambam discusses this Pasuk in Hilchos Yisod HaTorah about how in love with God, what Ahavas Hashem means. Alright? So the question is, you know, Shin Gimel means to be like a shkia, shoge, means to be lightheaded. I mean, make mistakes. You know, you're supposed to run around just like, oh, I love God so much. You know, maybe here, you know, I remember there was a play like this. That guy didn't remember, but there was a play where the secretary comes in and she's like lightheaded. You can't take it with you, maybe. I mean. But I put it on in eighth grade, my yeshiva. She was all Asian. And she's like very lightheaded, and someone says, oh, you must be in love. She was. Right? In other words, is that the Rambam? The Rambam's gonna say that's the advice that Shlomo is giving us? To be so in love with God that you start skipping stop signs and you start walking into buildings? That's what you should be. Stop tishke, you start making mistakes because you're so in love? That can't be. So Rashi helps us here, and he says, in the Arabic, this word, tishge, means what Hebrew this word means, tasok. Tishge is not a Hebrew word there. It's borrowed from Arabic. And it means, ba'avasot tasok tamid. In love with someone, every day, every few hours, think, what can I do for her? See, if you're in the courting stage, it's a little selfish. What can I do to make sure that she loves me in return, right? So you're going to buy her flowers, you're going to take her to a nice place, you know, and it's the first day, so you go out for coffee at Coffee Bean. When you try to impress her, you really tasok, it's amazing. You're thinking it out. What kind of flowers does she like? Does she like jewelry? Take it to the next step. All right, anyway. But you should continue doing that when you're married 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, because it's an asek. Don't take anything for granted. So in what looks like a Hebrew word, that pasuk is difficult. By the way, in the Hilchos Yesod HaTorah, where the Rambam discusses this, is the Ravid takes issue with the Rambam's meaning of this word tishye. Now, the Ravid has his glosses on the Rambam's halachos. But in Hilchos Yesod HaTorah, the Rambam doesn't just talk about practical halach. Talks about, you know, how are we supposed to behave with God? So in the Hebrew, again, this word looks Hebrew. It's a problematic pasuk. All right. If we borrow from Arabic, which Rashi does, Rashi did not speak Arabic fluently for sure, but he quotes Arabic often enough. It's a Semitic language. All right. There was a nation called Arav. Right. It's mentioned in the Torah and the prophets mentioned. Place called Arab, that's Arabia. So okay, they had their language. And I must tell you, the medieval commentaries that spoke fluent Arabic, that would be anyone that you can think of? Ibn Ezra, right? And the grammarians, Chiyuj, Janach, I don't know if you can hear these names, you should have heard them already in sixth grade. But the grammarians and the exegetes, the commentaries who spoke fluent Arabic, were the superior commentaries, or at least grammarians. Not so much unlike the fact that somehow it has come down to the 21st century that the Sephardic Jews seem to be better at dictuk than Ashkenazi Jews. This isn't that the case here, right? Depending on the school you went to. But the Sfaradim are, I don't know, what is the reason? Is it cultural? Is it that the schools, whatever it is. But the Jews who lived in the Ashkenazic lands, Rashi, Dunam Shibat Namrat, Menachem Bar Chelbo, or Yosef Kara, these Jews, they were good grammarians, and I can make a good argument in another course that these Jews had a better sense for the sixth century, for the Hebrew language. But they did not have the benefit of being steeped in these Semitic languages to help them out. Right. So I'll just say the main difference between the Arabic and speakers and the non-Arabic speakers had to do with a two or three letter root system. Are you familiar with this machlokus? This raged for 200 years in the Middle East in the Middle Ages, and people wrote whole books showing how the other side was wrong, and it went on for 200 years. It went on even until Rabbeinu Tam's time, and the arguments stopped with the Radak. When the Radak of David Kimchi in the 13th century wrote his Michlol, his final book on Jewish grammar, on Hebrew grammar, he settled the score. He seems to be trying to make peace between the different positions of how to use Semitic languages and other root systems. Arabic has three letter root systems, and Rashi was of the opinion that Hebrew roots mostly have two, or possibly even one letter to the root. Did this ever come up in a grammar course in some place? I don't know. All right. Just in deference to Rashi's position, the Hebrew is the origin, because Rashi, this is Parshanut. Rashi in Bereishis Perek Yud Aleph says that the original language of the world, the language that Adam and Chava spoke, was Hebrew. Right? And everything moved off of Hebrew. His proof is, by the way, Ibn Ezra mentions this proof. Ibn Ezra, see, by this time, it's hard to figure what is pure parshanut and what is cultural or polemic in nature. You see, by the time that Ibn Ezra was writing his commentary, Islam was flourishing, Arabic was a great language of poetry and science and arithmetic, and the Muslims were lording it over Jews culturally, certainly militarily, right? And Jews and mass were converting to Islam, they were forcibly being converted to Islam. And that philosophically the two religions are quite close. Right? Very few Jews were willingly converting to Christianity with the sword at their neck, some did. But Jews were being culturally moved towards Islam. And the Islamic position was Hebrew is just sort of a stepchild of Arabic. So the commentaries exposed to that, like Sa'd Yigo and Ibn Ezra, etc., tried to show that Hebrew is superior to Arabic. Right? Hebrew is even older than Arabic. Right? These are the kinds of... I don't even know if you can appreciate what all this is about. But here's the point I'd like to make in deference to Rashi. Right? We are up to the part of the semester that just talks about language, and we're going to move quickly into narrative and mitzvahs. So let me just finish today or Thursday on this topic. Right? Take these two letters, Peresh. Whatever letter you add to this in Hebrew, I'm using this as an example because these two letters are the two letters in Hebrew that have allowed the most letters to come after it and is still a Hebrew word. Practically every letter of the Hebrew alphabet after these two letters is a Hebrew word. Right? So, and all of them have some basic root of meaning something that separation. Something that separates one thing from another. Pre-separates from... Yes.
This is an example that Rashi used to show that it's a two-letter root system? Or is it just...
I don't know if Rashi uses this specific example, but it could be used. But Rashi's basic thesis is that any time a letter falls out, take the word by yikol, so to Rashi, the nun is not part of the shorish, because it falls out. Right. There are some places where Rashi writes in his commentary to the Torah about letters that interchange and fall, but in general, this Rashi even says the word lahakot is the shorish is chof. There are one letter roots in Hebrew. So beat is chof. Okay. So just to put it out there, the Sephardim were very aloof of their Ashkenazic counterparts and felt that we were better than you in halacha, we're better than you in grammar, we're better than you because we speak Arabic, right? We know Semitic language better than you. Okay, so I'm just going to give you a few other specific examples. Here again, Rashi himself uses Arabic to explain this somewhat different word, right? Okay, back to Chazal. So Chazal used two Chamite languages to explain Tosafot. Right? That surely should open the door for us to use Semitic languages. Okay? I'll use just one example of a Yafet language. This is a Gemara in Sanhedrin. This is the Nahos. Fourth parrot. This is Sanhedrin. And the seventh parrot. Gemara, this is now a Parshanut issue. The Parshanut issue is as follows. It's a halachic issue. Gemara says if a man sleeps with a woman and that woman's mother, you shall kill him and them. Right? If a man sleeps with a woman X and X's mother, you shall kill him and them. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Rashi in his Perush al Torah, brings us down this question. It's a Parshanut question here. It's a halachic question. It's a moral question. What's the moral question? Yes?
Why are you killing these women?
What? Fine-tune that question a little. One of these women is doing something very roguish. One of them seems to be innocent. Right? Either the daughter of this man's wife, doesn't have to be his own daughter. Right? Or the mother of this man's wife. Or this wife do wrong. One of these women could be his wife.
What happened exactly?
I just said, a man sleeps with a woman and her mother. He could be married to one of them. So why are you killing the wife? What did she do wrong? He's having an affair with his mother-in-law. This guy's got obviously problems, but okay. Let's clear the gene pool of this nut. But why are you killing his wife?
Why are you killing him?
He's also doing something disgusting. Alright, but that's the pasuk. It's the pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim. Alright, it says kill him. They're very simple Hebrew words. Oso ve es hen.
Okay, the pasuk says gross his wife, or the pasuk says a daughter and a mother.
Doesn't matter. It could be his wife, and if it's not, tell me so. It just says if a man sleeps with a woman and her mother
at the same time. Wife.
What?
Obviously, it's not his wife.
Then say so.
Obviously.
All right, Rabbi Yishmael explains, but then the way he explains the pasuk is so remote. It's talking about his mother-in-law and her mother. Wow, he's got real problems. All right, so everybody agrees that
mother-in-law.
All right, in other words, he slept with a woman, and but this guy slept with a woman, her mother, and her grandmother. But the pasuk should say, should explain so. That's Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Kiva, however, get this. Guys, please. Rabbi Kiva says that Eshen does not mean them. Wait a second. I'm in the dictionary, that's what it means. It doesn't say Oson, it says Eshen, an unusual way to say them in feminine plural. Guys, turn in. Alright? So Rabbi Kiva says Eshen means kill him and what does hen in Greek mean? One. Hen means one of them. Kill him and one of them. Why does it say in plural? Because you don't know which one. Sometimes it's the mother of this woman. Sometimes it's the daughter of this woman. So the them goes on, either the mother or the daughter. So, all right, we say that. I find in I get papers from people now, and they're gender careful. So they say everyone has to watch their. You should say his or her. But they don't want to write so much. So now it's perfectly acceptable to write there, because there is gender neutral, even though you started in singular. So to here, the Torah is saying eshen. But of course, only one of them. I wouldn't kill a wife because her mother's a rogue. Her mother's having an affair with her husband. Would he kill the wife for that? Just him and one of them. But I don't know which one. In some cases, it's the daughter of this man's wife. In some cases, it's the mother of this man's wife. You with me? So it's all right, it's eshen. But fundamentally, what Rabbi Kiva is doing is he's using the Greek language for hen to explain this difficulty. This is a question, it's a moral question. Why are you killing a woman because she has a terrible mother or daughter? Yes?
Would you have been influential?
Certainly not!
Right.
But the Greek didn't exist. Greek was a nation. Avon is a nation that's as old as Aver.
Right, so I thought the other languages we were saying that we use to learn from the Torah are languages that were prevalent.
All right, a word here, a word there. Open up the Scrabble dictionary, and you'll see, goodness gracious. Look under S-C-H-M, and you'll find about 30 Yiddish words that are perfectly acceptable in Scrabble. I don't know if that makes sense. And it's in the Oxford Dictionary. Schmendrick. You know, I don't want to get too far here, but get in trouble. We're on tape, you know. But I don't know what gets into a language, right? Okay. All right. So, yes.
Didn't you say you killed him also?
But he's definitely a rogue. He's sleeping with his. Come on. So kill him.
One of the
Eshen. Kill him. The Eshen. All right. Okay, so you see this? So I'm using. Or how about this? Is even a better one because this is a problematic pasuk. Here, this isn't even a problematic pasuk, and it's a good Hebrew word. The Torah talks about a pre-Eitz Hadar, right? That's not. I wasn't. I never. There's no moral problem here in defining what Hadar means, and there's no intellectual. The question is, the only question you might have in Parshanut, look at the three words, tell me. What are the questions in Parshanut to explain these three words? It's also very much nogeya to Chava and looking at the tree and deciding why she wants to eat from that tree. Anyone ever? Come on, look at the three words and tell me. These three words can mean two different things. Nope.
Beautiful returning. Hadar.
Hadar means beautiful. Come on.
Not necessarily.
What's the beautiful thing here? Come on, guys.
The tree. Or
is it the fruit that's beautiful, or is it the tree that's beautiful? Is it a pre? Is it a fruit of a beautiful tree? Right? Hadar is a masculine word which can define both pre or eights. Is it a fruit of a beautiful tree, or is it?
Tree that has fruit.
A beautiful fruit of a tree. Is it a. So, what can you, if you open up a chumash, what can you use to determine the answer to this question? Underused. I usually teach this in my intro class. Underused. But that's why when you bar mitzvah, you learned how to lay. The shrub can help you determine. Pre-Eitz Hadar. Okay. It's not a beautiful fruit at all. You ever taste one? It doesn't even look beautiful. It smells nice. The tree is beautiful. The Hadar is something that the Hadar describes the tree, not the fruit. Look at by Chava when she's looking at the tree. She says nothing about the fruit. Kitova ate the machol. There's something about the tree that was enticing to her, not the fruit. We don't even know what the fruit is. The Torah doesn't tell us. Alright? So there is a parshanut issue of what these three words mean. Right? There is an issue. What does the Torah mean when it says these three words? Is it describing the tree? Is it describing the fruit? So Gemara said, all right, the Pashup Shah Hadar means Hidr Mitzvah. You've heard of that, right? The Gemara then makes a drash. Have any of you ever actually seen the estrog on the tree? It is by far and away on planet Earth. Nothing even comes close to how connected this fruit is to the tree. Only way to get it off the tree is to take a fireman's clipper and cut it off. You cannot pull this off. An apple, just pull it off. You apple picking, pull off an orange. You will not get the estrog off the tree with your hand. You need something. Look at the bottom of it. It's tied to the tree with such a firm. It'll stay on there forever. Now, what does that mean now? Look at it. Creates. That lives. It's a dog. Get it? It lives on its tree. And it'll stay there, even from year to year, until someone pulls it off. An apple, like a woman, will give birth and let the tree, it'll fall off the tree. Come what may, you can't hold on to the baby forever, you can't hold on to that apple forever. It's going to get too heavy and it'll fall off by itself. Right? But not in a stroke. It's hador, you get it? A drasha. Because the pshat is obviously a beautiful tree, or beautiful fruit. But now we're making drushes, because we know a little about this Esrog. Then comes the Gemara to make a third drusha, and it says, it's a tree, I didn't know this, I'm not a horticulturist, but it's a tree that needs water more than most other trees. How do you see that? Because in Greek, how do you say water? So hador is actually a Greek word. Creates hador. A tree that grows near its... Because, see, when the Torah doesn't give you a hint what this fruit is. You know, Karaites don't take an esrog on sukkahs. Right? You know what a karait is, right? They don't have Torah Shabbat. We talked about that in those class, didn't we? We talked about... Sheishanim ta'o v'yamashi kishpoz v'yamashi kishpoz v'yamashi. I sometimes get mixed up between my and my friends. Alright, but Karaites don't have a Torah Shabbat. They only keep what's written in the Torah. So how do they know what fruit to take on Sukkot? So Karaites have a lot of independence. Everybody does what they like. Your Pri Yetzer is not necessarily your Pri Yetzer Hara. But take something you think is, they believe in me, they agree with me, it's beautiful. You think this is a beautiful fruit. You don't want to take a quince, you want to take a plum. But take something. A little crazy, right? That's why there are not too many Karaites, because this kind of chaotic approach to the Torah does not foster continuity. Agree? Just take whatever. I mean, but the creed of Karaism is Hapisu Be'oraisa Shapir, Aramaic. Search the Torah well, the Al Tishanu Al Da'ati. Don't rely on my opinion. You want to take this? You want to? So everybody do. Right? It's an interesting theory at first, but it did not sustain itself. Any Miki Karaites lately? Yes.
Why do you dismiss the possibility of Aramaic influence?
That means
Zara. A form of returning to do the mitzvah properly. I read an article.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I don't doubt that's such a perish. I'm not familiar with it, but it can make its way into a perish. But it's not the pshat. As long as you admit that it's not the pshat, go ahead. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? You know, in terms of what pshat means. In other words, the essence of this pasuk is to take something of beauty. The Gemara made a drash. And your pshat maybe just as legitimate as saying it's a tree that sticks to the tree, that's dar on the tree. Because if that's what it means, you should use the better word than that. But here, the Torah purposely uses a word that does a lot of business, like in the hadran alach, you know what I'm going to say to me. That's the beauty of the Hebrew language. Yes?
I understand the idea that the first Hebrew is a Lashon HaKodesh with the fact that it was influenced by other languages and has long words.
Oh, this is why I started the classes I did. Yes, because, you know, and especially because it took on polemical tendencies in the Middle Ages, where the Muslims were saying, see, we build better structures than you do, right? We have a better Bible than you do. Our Quran is far superior to your Torah, because you falsified your Torah. You put Yitzchak as Avram's favorite, and you put in your Torah that Yishmael was sent away, and in the Quran it's the opposite. Right? Okay, so the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Septuagint and the Christian Bibles that are much older than the Quran. We don't have Bibles older than the Quran. They've been all destroyed. We didn't have the ways to preserve them. So they say, well, our Quran is older than your oldest Torah, so we're right, you're wrong. Go fight them. If you annoy them or antagonize them, your whole town is destroyed. All right, so Jews living in this background, it started to become personal. Right? When they're saying our language is superior to yours, our poetry is superior to yours, our science is superior to yours, our buildings are superior to yours, our Bible is superior to yours. So Jews started to become, you know, polemical in nature. And Jews started to say that the Torah's original language is Hebrew. Any of you can figure any hint in the Garden of Eden story that it's Hebrew and not Arabic? I guess no little Arabic. But there is another opinion in the Sechas Sanhedrin in the fourth parak that says that the original language spoken by the Menchaga was Aramaic. Right? But let's get back to Hebrew. When Adam sees there's a piece of him missing on the side, And he realizes that there's, hey, there's ladies here. That's the old man. I don't know if you're old enough to remember that. But anyway, so he's noticed that there's a partner for him, as opposed to all the animals that have a partner. And now he's got a partner, right? And he names her. He calls her, but the Torah gives her another name later, because there are two Adams and there are two Eves, and it's the nicest little thing that the Rav does. But he names her Isha. Can I teach you braces? He made Ish Lukacha. Called her Isha because she's taken from. So the clever Ibn Ezra shows that in Arabic, in Aramaic, in any language that's mentioned in the Torah that you might argue is older than Hebrew, there were no Akkadians or Ugarites left at the time of these discussions who were arguing that those are older languages. So in the languages where they were discussing these things, they showed that the word for man and woman was not so similar. Right? You feminize Hebrew words with a hey. Right, it's true that the word Isha does not have the yud in it, which could be significant. It's Ish and Isha. Not Isha. It's Isha. Alright? When a chirik has a yud after it, it's E-E. When a chirik does not have a yud afterwards, it is a shvach, a small, a short I. It. Isha. It's the correct, really the correct way to pronounce that. Not Yisrael, it's Yisrael. See? Alright. Okay. So the commentaries started to argue that see, if you would never say something like, I shall call her Itasa, because from a Gavra she was taken. That's ridiculous. Right? But to call her Isha, Kime Ish Lukach Zos, so right? That's, you see, a little tangent, but the Christians and Jews polemicized about how she was taken from him and how Adam came to name her this. Rashi brings down to Gemara in Sanhedrin that Adam, when he saw her, he said, Zos Hapan, this one is different. Right? This one is different. Why would Rashi, why would Adam say this one is different? Look at the Rashi. Very controversial, because then Christians accuse Jews of being sexually corrupt. And the Christian argument was to be very, very ascetic and very, they didn't enjoy life too much. And Christians were very much denied themselves, and they said that for them better to be celibate altogether if you can. So when Adam says Zos Hapan, he says because he tried out all the animals first. And so no, they don't fit. But when he saw Chava, he said, "Oh, this one's different. This one is Etzamei Atzamai, and we fit together, right?" So the Christians didn't like that parish, and you see that there were a lot of Middle Ages. Right. Look how corrupt the Jews are. Look at one of their commentaries writes. Their main commentary. So Rashi's grandson, Rashbam, this you can take my polemics course. Rashbam was very sensitive to what Christians were saying about our commentaries and about our Torah. But you had to be very careful. If you came out outright, and said, Mr. Pesnik, and if you came out and you said the Christians say this and this is why they're wrong, they would kill you. They would kill you and destroy your works. Right? Their censors were censorious. And they had plenty of apostate former Jews to point out who's saying what. So if you wanted to say something against Christianity or to give an answer for your own sviva of how you deal with what they're saying about our Torah, you have to be very careful how you said it. And let me tell you something. Your average Shabbos morning shul experience at that time, the priests came into the shuls and gave you an hour-long lecture on Shabbos morning why you should be converted to Christianity. And you could not go to Kiddush Club during that time. Right? They made sure they packed the shuls. I want all your kids, I want everybody hearing why they should be converted. Right? It's not a good scene. Okay, Rashbam writes, it's it's very cute, by the way. If you haven't heard it, at least you'll remember the Chak. Rashban says, what was different this time is that he recognized how a woman was taken from me, right? But he had the wisdom to know that it's not going to be like that anymore. Only this time, the first birth in human history, as far as the narratives of our Torah has it, is that a man gave birth to a woman. A little piece of him, he gave birth to her. Take it out, that's birth. But that's not how it's going to be from now on. He recognized, Zosapam, me'ish lukocho. She was taken from a man. But from now on, everybody, men and women, are going to be taken from the woman. And therefore she was named afterwards Chava. Right? One who gives life to everyone else. But the first birth, Zosapam, so why am I telling you all this? Because we see that when it comes to these issues of influence from other languages, there are a lot of issues at hand. There are moral issues, there are simple linguistic issues, but there are also parshanut issues at hand. And that's going to be a really exciting part of some of what we're doing as we move on, as we see things in the ancient Near East, which really shed positive light on how to understand sometimes a whole story, a whole mitzvah. Right? When you see some Nabataean and Sabian ancient practices, it's going to give you a whole different attitude towards why we separate milk and meat, why we give bikurim, why we do certain things in the Torah. And then after it all, you're going to say, you know, Rabbi, well, what would the Torah look like if we didn't have these practices? I don't know and I don't care. The Torah was not given in a vacuum. And I understand this has been a problem since the Rambam started to explain the Torah this way. Is that I can picture in 1850 or in 1950 or in 2015, a conservative or reformed Jew saying, okay, I agree with all the scholarship, but what does it do for me? No one's doing those things anymore, so why do I need to not eat a cheeseburger? Right? So the Orthodox Jew responds to this and says that the Torah is everlasting. Whatever deeper message the Torah is giving with these mitzvahs or these points is everlasting, and that there's a philosophical notion behind it. Even if there are no pagans that we have to respond to, and I'll give specific examples, many, when we get up to it. Okay, let's get back to our. So you have all these examples of Yefit languages, Hamite languages, and we even have another Yefit languages in Sukkah. Right, the Chav Zayin talks about the pre-Eitzatah. Okay. There it's a parshanut issue. Right? What is the thing? Is this a tree or is it the fruit? The consensus in all of the Mepharshim, by the way, is that it's the tree, not the fruit. Right? It's the tree that it resides on. It's the tree that's near the water. It's the tree that's beautiful. It's the tree that. Right? Okay. And by the way, in the same parsha, it's a few parakim later, the Torah speaks about how to treat an older person. What's the lashon in the Torah? Vehodarta p'nei zokein. Vehodarta p'nei zokein. That's beautiful. Because in the ancient world, especially in the Egypt we just came from, youth was everything. They wanted to mummify bodies so that they, you know, people only can grow a beard because we want everybody to be youthful. So here comes the Torah to say, no, I want all men with facial hair. Right? Unless you can take it off with a depilatory, but no razors on the face. Right? So the Torah is giving beauty to old age. Isn't that amazing? You get it? Behadarta pnei zokein. Creates hador. It's a beautiful tree because the fruit stays on there until it's old age. It doesn't fall off when the gestation period is over like every other fruit. Alright? So the Torah is now creating culture through these linguistic points. And the two psukim take a pre-ace hador and Dr. Pnezapin. One is in Perkov, one is in Perkov Gimel. It's one right after the other. That's more for a parshanut class of how the Torah uses certain phraseologies, one, you know, next to the other to render a connection. It's stuff for drushes, but okay. So that is. So I rest my case. I don't think I need to prove to you much more. when you do run into a word like this, so the works to use that are on your front page are the Brown Driver and Briggs, the lexicon to the New Testament, and Tawil's work, the Akkadian lexicon, are excellent works that will help you with these. And if you're taking a course like an EOV or something to that effect, then you run into words every third or fourth pasuk that'll challenge Hebrew. To the point that some scholars claim that Eov was originally written in Aramaic and then translated into Hebrew. It makes sense. The story takes place in Uz. Uz is the capital of Aram in the ancient world. Why would they speak Hebrew? Right? These are not Jews. These are not Hebrews. These are not Israelites. These are God-fearing people. Right? But there's nothing Jewish per se about the book. Chazal say Moshe Rabbeinu wrote it. But it's meant to be philosophical about reward and punishment and human suffering. But there's nothing particularly Israelitish about it. So scholars say that they spoke in Aramaic, just the same way that I imagine that Paro spoke to Moshe in Egyptian, and that someone translates it. Right? That leads to the interesting perush that not only is found in the avant-garde perush Ibn Ezra, but also in the very traditionalist parish, the Bali Atosfus, that says that when Paro's daughter sees a boy in the water, right, you think all of a sudden she starts speaking Hebrew? She named him Moshe Kimin Amayim Mishisiyu. That's Hebraized. It's not the same word in Egyptian. The Das Akkadian doesn't do this, but Ibn Ezra does. He said he went to find out how to say in ancient Egyptian to raise out of water. Right? And he says it's Monis. He says his name in Egyptian would be Monis. And in ancient Egyptian, he says that Meses means my son in ancient Egyptian. Like Ramses is the son of Ra. So Meses, that's very close to what we know, our English terminology for this man's name. And you see it, Batilo Leben became her son. But to say that Paro's daughter just all of a sudden in a peak of prophecy starts speaking Hebrew out of nowhere. Maybe she did speak Hebrew in deference to all these slaves that are here. I don't know. It doesn't make much sense. But it's that the Bible Hebraizes the Moshe's name. Right? Or Parshanut now, if you look carefully at the Pasuk, it could be that Yocheved named him. Look carefully in the Pasuk. It says, she brought him to her, and she named him Moshe Kibin Hamayim Mishisim. The Pashup Shot is that the one naming him is the one receiving the baby. But it could be that the one naming the baby is the one bringing the baby over after he was weaned. Right? You see the Pasuk in the beginning of Shmos. You see. It could be Yocheved name, and Yocheved did speak Hebrew, so then, okay, that could work. You have to work that through. Right? So or in the movie, The Ten Commandments, remember she picks him up and says, and because I raised you from the water, I shall call you Moses. Huh? What is that? What sense does that make? You should name him Andrew or Drew. Right? Okay, so this is okay. I think I'm resting my case.
Well, I couldn't have done the thing also get some more translation. Along the same lines as the Moshe human mind initiative, the Ishisha.
Maybe they spoke Chinese? I don't know.
Maybe. I mean, like,
okay. No, I don't. Conjecture. You can always can always draw, but I want more convincing proof.
How would that be convincing that Hebrew was the original language if we had in the Torah itself, like things translated Hebrew?
As far as that Das Akkadian goes, or Ibn Ezra, you can make that similar type of suggestion. Yes, Mechanan. Okay. All right. So this will close just there's a couple of pages there from Encyclopedia Judaica that just fortifies some of this material. And there's just one other. If you turn a few pages, you'll see that there is a book by a man named Wolf. It's on the. Yeah, that's it. You're looking at it right there. Right. So he takes some phrases, right? Just look, through some of those. I think I might have mentioned one or two that I actually put in. Just read through that. It's really very, very simple. Okay? And what I'd ask you is to just do the following for Thursday. Take any example he gives, it's usually one or two words. Just write down the two words. It should take you about a half of a page. And leave it here on Thursday how that word means what he says it means. Okay? It's very simple. It's taking more than 5 to 10 minutes here.
I'm sorry. Okay?
This is I.G. Wolf. Some quotes, some lexicographical comments on the Hebrew Bible. Okay? For instance, he claims Bereshis Bara Elokim, that Bara does not mean created. He uses Semitic languages to show that Bara means something else. Alright? You know, that should, I mean, it could take you 2 minutes. Just you do any one example he uses there. Alright?
Say what he says.
And see, write down, but you have to read through it. It's about a page, page and a half. You know. Okay? Use any example. And I think I think on the very first class I gave this example there. Where 4 times in the Torah, in the Tanakh, a man threatens to kill off every mashtin bekir in this place. Right? I think I gave you some of the English translations. Mashtin bekir can mean every dog, every man that urinates on the wall. Bekir is a wall. Mashtin is the word in the Talmud for urinate. Mashtin bekir, everyone who urinates against the wall. That could mean every dog. Okay, so I'm not sure if I gave you that example there, but... so good. Okay. So see what he does there. It's very cute, actually. It's a big finish each time. All right. Yes.
How do they know when to apply this?
So in this particular book, there's about 200 examples in the entire book, and he takes difficult phraseologies. You know, why would David tell on a guy to kill every mashtin bekir? We don't use that phraseology today.
Okay.
Right. You know, and what do we say? What a lucky dog. What would that mean in a society that... What does a lucky dog mean?
What about Mara?
So, yeah, that I'm not to agree with him. I just gave it to you to show his ingenuity. Because usually, you're asking a good question. Help me out when I come across a difficult phrase.
How do I know what to... How would we know after leaving this class how to apply the knowledge you gave us?
So, I would that's why I'm giving you different examples here. Some... it's when it's a difficult phrase. Bereshis Bara Elokim was not bothering anybody. Right? But he shows you in other usages of the word why my interpretation here is correct.
But assuming we don't have the keys at all.
Maybe all the time you will. But okay, when you run into he has an index, an alphabetical index. So if you ever run into a particularly difficult phrase that leads to either a moral issue or a philosophical issue or a halachic issue, and then you see that, you know, there's a deal with it. Okay, all right. I think I'll let you out with that, and we're going to move next time into more parshanut issues. All right. We're going to move away from linguistics, languages, to we're going to make a segue towards Bereshis and Shmos.